Blog Talk Radio.
Yaron Brook Show. This is Don Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. Now, typically when Yaron is away, it's because he is traveling the world and speaking. But actually right now he is in an undisclosed location being held for ransom. And basically here's the deal. You guys need to help us get Equal is Unfair on the New York Times bestseller list. So if you want Yaron back, go to the store. Buy a copy. If you bought a copy, buy three copies. If you have it in book form, get it in Audible. Get it in Kindle. Help us drive those sales. No, Yaron is actually in Brazil right now. We've been traveling around the country and indeed the world speaking on the ideas in Equals Unfair. And been some really, really cool experiences. I spoke. One of the coolest things was we at our launch event, Yaron and I were on a panel discussing inequality. And fortunately, the whole place was sold out. We couldn't fit anybody else in, but we actually had to turn away a bunch of high school students. And I had the fortunate opportunity to go into Queens and the next day and speak to them. And it was a really fun experience. So these are just some eager kids. They were really into free market ideas, asked really good questions. And so definitely a highlight for me. We've been off to a good start too. Number one on the Conservative Book Club bestsellers list. And we popped up in some other places, but still a lot to do to get close to challenging the inequality debate and really changing how it goes. So pick up your copy of the book and, really share it with your friends. Let us know what you think and help us get the ideas out there. So what are we talking about today, though? Not inequality, although that's really going to be an aspect of what we're talking about. We are really going to be, what's the opposite of celebrating? We're going to be lamenting tax day, usually April 15th, actually April 18th this year. So before I get started, though, a quick note. Do not call in today. I'm pre-recording this. I'm sorry to admit to you, but I will be watching the Twitter feed when this goes live. So you can get in contact with me, send your questions, comments at dwatkins3. Dwatkins, the number three, completely unintuitive and hard for you to remember. I know, but I will be watching and we can keep the discussion going. So you've probably heard, even if you haven't followed the news too closely, of the Panama Papers. And this is basically a whole bunch of papers having to do with banking in Panama have been released, made public. And this has really set off a firestorm. Now, it's not even clear that there's a story here. The closest that we've gotten has been some examples of potential conflicts of interest. It's not obvious that anybody's been doing anything illegal. That remains to be seen. But this has really set up a firestorm about a conversation about tax avoidance, tax evasion, and the eternal question, are the rich paying their fair share of taxes? Now, this is definitely, whatever else you can say about it, not a U.S. story. That as far as I've seen, only one U.S. business, one you've never heard of, has shown up in these records. But there is this larger conversation that's being tapped into about whether rich individuals or successful companies are paying their fair share or are they not. And there's kind of three claims that are made regarding this issue. So one is that the U.S. tax code is already tilted in the favor of the rich. That basically they can, even following the laws, get away with paying way less than they should. The second idea has to do with that they're doing something bad when they use their high-priced lawyers and accountants to try to minimize their tax bill, when they try to avoid taxes, totally within the law, but just when they use special tools or gimmicks, allegedly, to lower their tax bill, that something is going wrong. Something is, they are being unfair. Then the final claim, and this is usually unsupported. You very rarely get specific companies or specific things that these companies are supposedly doing, and that is that they're actually engaged in outright tax evasion, that they're doing things that are illegal in order to keep their money out of the government's hands. And so in one way or another, the rich are not paying their fair share. So I want to set the Panama Papers aside, because again, I don't think this is really, I don't think this has much to add, certainly to the U.S. debate. But this bigger question of are the rich paying their fair share of taxes is interesting. Now, don't get ahead of me. I know that most of the people listening to this show are screaming right now, that is a lousy question. We'll see. It is a lousy question. But sometimes it's helpful to take a lousy question and just look at it on its own terms before tearing the question itself apart. And I think there's some interesting things to say on that front. Before I turn to that, just want to let you know later in the show, we're going to be talking about some events that are coming up from ARI, and also a really interesting undertaking by an organization called Strive, which we've talked about in the show before. And so stay tuned towards the end of the show. We'll have that. But for now, let's jump right in. So are the rich paying their fair share of taxes? Now, first of all, let's just get some facts on the table. Here's a really interesting story. This is from the Washington Beacon a few days ago. The headline is $1.48 trillion. Government collects record high taxes in first half of fiscal year 2016. And the basic conclusion of this article is that just in the first half of this fiscal year, which is just wrapping up, that inflation adjusted federal tax revenues, the amount of money the government has taken in from taxes, greater than it has ever been in human history, $1.48 trillion. The article also notices that notes, boy, it's going to be a long show if that keeps up. The government also managed to be $461 billion in the hole, even with this record taxes. So they're spending way, way more. But I think this is really interesting just because we constantly hear that taxes are too low. Taxes are sometimes, we'll hear, historically low, or at least they were a few years ago. Maybe, maybe not. Depends on what we even mean by those terms. But one thing is for sure, the government is not hurting from tax revenues. It is hurting from overspending. When you get the greatest tax take in history, in American history, and you still can't pay your bills, something's wrong. And I don't think that the conclusion is likely going to be you're not taxing enough. But let's even put this in a little bit more perspective. So really great organization, the Tax Foundation, has some just great studies on the state of taxation. So this is from a report they recently put out, Tax Freedom Day. And Tax Freedom Day is basically saying, when does the average American get through paying his taxes? If everything he earned went towards taxes, when is he able to start making money for himself? And Tax Freedom Day this year, let's see if I can find that. It's sometime in late April, but there's 2 points in this report that I found just flabbergasting. I guess not that surprising, but it's outrageous that this is not surprising. So from the report, Americans will pay $3.3 trillion in federal taxes and $1.6 trillion in state and local taxes this year for a total bill of almost $5 trillion. Or 31% of the, quote, nation's income. So if you add up all of our incomes, 31% is going to the government. Put those are numbers. It's hard to wrap your head around them. But this one, this really, I think, drives home what that means. Americans will collectively spend more on taxes in 2016 than they will on food, clothing, and housing combined. Food, clothing, and housing, still spending more on government. Almost $1 trillion more on taxes. All right, so the starting point in any discussion of what the fair share of the rich is, we are paying a gargantuan tax bill, all of us, in one way or another. And so whatever else we should could say, I think that even that is a big, big bill. So how is that bill being divided? I love analogies, and this is a great one from Stephen Moore, who's a friend of the Institute, works at Heritage, and he gives this analogy to how that tax bite is actually divided up. Here's what Moore says. Suppose there were a banquet for 100 people, and at the end of the night, it was time to split the bill of $50 per person. If that bill were paid for the way we pay our income taxes, here's how it would work. Those in the top half of income would pay roughly $97 each, and those in the bottom half of the income would pay an average of $3 each. Almost 40 people would pay nothing, and the single richest person in the room would cough up $1,750. And he says liberals would complain that the cheapskate rich guy got away without paying his fair share. So let's break down that analogy. So that was written last year, so the numbers might be a little bit different, but you get the point. It's that by if we're actually looking, focusing today on income taxes, it is the highest earners who are paying a ridiculously high proportion of the overall tax bill. So this is another report. Now, this was from the Tax Foundation. This came out last year, and they're working with 2013 numbers. It takes a while to study and tally these things, but the basic facts on the ground haven't changed. So in 2013, this is what we get. The share of income earned by the top 1% of taxpayers fell to 19% in 2013. So that means if we total up everybody's income, how much did the top 1% contribute to that total pie? 19%. So they got 19% of total income. Their share of federal income taxes fell a little bit, but it was 37.8%. So they get they earn 19% of the income, but their taxes supply 37.8% of what the government takes in through income taxes. In 2012, the top 50% of all taxpayers paid 97.2% of all income taxes. The bottom 50% paid the remaining 2.8%. So we're starting to get a sense that it's a pretty progressive tax code. If we're looking at who's actually carrying the burden, overwhelmingly it's people towards the top, at least the top half. But now we can zero in a little more on the 1%. The top 1% paid a greater share of income taxes, 37.8%, than the bottom 90% combined. And final point here, the top 1% of taxpayers paid a higher effective income tax rate than any other group at 27.1%, which is over 8 times higher than taxpayers in the bottom 50%. 3.3%. So you know what the effective income tax rate, it's not the marginal income tax. It's not the percent that's taken for whatever the next dollar they earned is. It's if we just basically total up their income and total up their tax bill, 27%, over 27% is what they're paying just to federal income taxes. So those are the numbers. We don't want to get too numberish and wonkish on the show. This is we come at this from a perspective of philosophy, but I think it's important before we even get into the question of what it means to say a fair share, to say is what they're objecting to, what the inequality critics who bemoan that the rich aren't paying their fair share, what they're objecting to is a situation in which they already pay the overwhelming amount of the tax burden, significantly more the degree of their earnings. That is, if they earn 19% of the total income and are paying close to 30% of the total tax bill, they still don't think that they're carrying enough of the burden. So I think just with a little common sense, that should at least make us a little skeptical of their view. But now let's dig into the actual meaning of this idea of fair share. So what do they even mean when they say a fair share? Well, they certainly don't give you any specific number. They don't tell us what is the fair share of the quote rich. And they don't even tell us who qualifies as the rich for that matter. But there is a meaning to it. There is a meaning that's worth highlighting. So first of all, you have to understand how they think of society and government, because it is, whatever you can say about it, it is not the way that the founders did. So if the founding fathers viewed government as a servant that had a specific but very delimited role of protecting our rights, they view government really as something very different. It's not about protecting individual rights. It's not about a delimited function. And it really goes down to their deepest view of what a society is. Society, on their view, and this is really shared by everyone on the left, I'm going to focus on the inequality critics. They're very dominant there anyway and really shape the way the left thinks about this. But it's more specific than the left, where it's not even clear what that means. So anyway, they view society as a collective undertaking, as a collective undertaking. So you might think that society is just the aggregate of individuals living their lives, dealing with other individuals, forming associations, forming businesses. No, 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 no. You got it all wrong, say the inequality critics. Society is a collective undertaking. We're all in this together. And the government's not a servant performing a delimited function, although they may pay lip service to that language sometimes. The way, if you've ever watched one of our debates with, say, Demos, which is one of these so-called progressive think tanks, this is how they love to put it. You hear this all over the place, but it's government. It's not an agent of force. It's not an agent of coercion. It's how we do things together that we can't do separately. That's all it is. It's that society is a collective undertaking. So how does society act in unison? Well, it's through the government. Now, if you ask them, well, why is it that government can get us to do things collectively that we can't do voluntarily and individually? The fact is, they'd at the end of the day, have to say, well, the government can force everybody to act in a certain way. So, I mean, it's really an evasion of the issue. But just to get at how they think about it, we have society acting collectively through the government. So what in that context is our fair share of taxes? What does it mean to do your fair share as part of this collective undertaking? Well, think about other cases where we use this terminology of fair share, because it does come up, I think, in some legitimate contexts. I'm sure all of you at one time or another had to do, say in school, a group project. So, you know, we have to do a group book report, and, you know, we'll divide up the work. Okay, Don, you do a chapter. Yaron, you do a chapter. Angela, you do a chapter. We'll all do a chapter, and then we'll, you know, put everything together. Everybody has their role, and your job is to do your fair share. What does it mean not to do your fair share? Well, if you don't do your job, if you're not carrying your part of the burden, you're not living up to your part of the deal. So one thing that the inequality critics might mean, if they're talking about paying your fair share of taxes, is that, well, we should all pay the same amount of money, right? Just as we would divide up a school project by everybody takes, an equal amount of the project. Well, we should divide up the tax bill, right? Everybody pays the same. You pay $1,000, I pay $1,000. Now, clearly, this is not what the inequality critics think. Another thing they might think, maybe every citizen should pay the same percent of their income. So, for instance, everybody pays 20%. Bill Gates should pay 20%. Don, who does not have as much money as Bill Gates, pay 20%. Everybody pays 20% or whatever the percent is. Now, that's already starting to make you wonder, well, is that really fair? Because Bill Gates having to pay 20%, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars, and I'm going to be paying, well, I'm not going to tell you exactly what it would be, but let's just say it's not going to be hundreds of millions of dollars. Why should he have to pay so much more just because it's small, you know, just because that's the same proportion of his income. Nevertheless, you can at least think, all right, there's something that's at least plausible about that as fairness. But what the inequality critics have in mind is way, way worse, way, way more perverse. So their view is that the greater the amount of money you earn, the greater a portion of your income that you have an obligation to pay to the government. So it's not just that you should pay more absolute income because you make more money. It's that the more money you make, the greater a portion of what you make is owed to the government, is owed to society in this collective undertaking. Think about that group project for a minute. Let's translate that into what would that mean for the group project? Well, it's if you're twice as smart as me, you know, we got our three group members. One of us, though, is twice as smart. He should have to do three times as much work. Because he's so good, his burden of the work should be way, way higher. Now, you might even come up with a slogan for this view of what fairness means, right? That the more you achieve, the better you are, the more talented, the more successful, the more penalties you endure. Why don't we could put it this way, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. And I think that's really, when they talk fair share, your fair share is what? It's the more you can afford, the more you've created, the more you've achieved, the more you owe, the more you're in need, the more you can't support yourself, the less you achieve. Well, the more you're entitled to what other people have. And where does that end? How much is your fair share on that kind of scenario? Well, it's basically whatever those in power can get away with. However much we can take from you without hurting the common good. It's really interesting. You can see this in more concrete terms in the debate over what should marginal tax rates be. How much should we tax the rich? And Paul Krugman he's always great on these things because he's so explicit. He has come out and, you know, debated what should the top marginal tax rate is. And what's interesting is not the number that he comes up with, although I think he inclines to agree with people like Piketty who talk about top marginal rates in the area of 70, 80, perhaps even more. For him, though, the only consideration is when do taxes on the wealthy undermine economic growth? When is it bad for other people in society? In other words, we should take as much money from we don't have to worry about the rights of people to their income. That's beside the point. It doesn't matter if you, quote, earned your money, they would say. The only thing that matters is we should take as much as we possibly can, as long as it doesn't undermine growth, undermine progress so much as to hurt people who earn less. So this really comes from the egalitarian philosopher John Rawls. And his basic idea is we should make society as equal as possible, but not necessarily fully equal. You only drive down inequality to the point where to drive it down anymore, that would make the worst off in society even worse off. So make that more vivid. I want to tax Steve Jobs basically as much as I possibly can at the point where if I taxed him even more, he wouldn't create Apple, or he wouldn't put in as much work to make Apple an amazing company. But I owe no consideration to Steve Jobs as such. It's just I want to make sure I have the maximum amount of his money to give to other people. And that's really how they think about fairness and taxes. Our goal is to take as much money as possible from the rich, so without hurting the common good, the quote unquote common good. Now, of course, the real issue is that this is a bad question. It's a loaded question. This view that it's based on, this view of society, is a collective undertaking, and the government is there to help this collective undertaking by pursuing the good of society, and that our moral obligation is to pay for this to the extent of our ability That, I think you guys know, is a wrong view, to say the least. That the American view, and this is certainly Ayn Rand's view, and certainly my view, the government is a servant. It's a servant. It doesn't own our income. And we're not immoral when we try to reduce our taxes and keep more of our income. No, it's exactly the opposite. The government is immoral to the extent it seizes our income. That's what's unfair. It's the government that we have to be concerned with in this issue of fairness. It's to the extent that they're taking money that we earned, that's what's unfair. But let's explore this idea further. This idea that taxation is what's unfair, not how much money you keep from the tax collectors. Because I think the way that we talk about it, the way that we talk about taxes as people who support free markets and capitalism, it's actually often ineffective. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to start with a really interesting trend that's been going around, a meme that's been going around the internet, that taxation is theft. Stay tuned.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind? A hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades? The need to prove superiority? Or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? From a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. 7 great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
We are back on the Yaron Brook Show. This is Don Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. And we are talking about everybody's favorite topic, taxes. How can we pay more? How can we support the government? All right. I assume that I fooled exactly nobody there. So I started noticing maybe a week or two ago these memes popping up in my Facebook and Twitter feeds of taxation is theft. And I was asked by some of you guys on Facebook to comment on this and what I thought about it. So I would say I find it mildly amusing, but totally unpersuasive. So as kind of like a just, you know, inside joke among people who are for free markets. Okay, kind of clever. And some of those memes are just hilarious. I think many are not that funny, but there are some definite good ones. But if this is kind of like your, well, let me put it this way. So I for my last book, Roosevelt Care, I was going around the country talking about so-called entitlements and particularly Social Security. And a number of times, you know, I would give a 30, 40 minute talk and answer questions, and somebody would come up to me inevitably and say, "Don, why'd you waste so much time? Why don't you just point out that, you know, Social Security is paid for by taxes and that's stealing and stealing's wrong." And my view was, well, is that going to convince anyone? And I think there's a reason it doesn't convince them. And I want to come to that. But first, let's start out with everybody's other favorite topic, which is the dictionary. So I think it's important to be clear on just what the concept theft is. And then I think that gives us a lead to why it just saying taxation is theft, it doesn't really move the ball in the direction we want it to go. So my dictionary defines theft as stealing. Okay, not very helpful. But it actually does give a definition of stealing. So it defines it as to take another person's property without permission or legal right and without intending to return it. The phrase without legal right is important. If I take something that I have a legal right to, then I'm not stealing. I'm not engaged in theft. And so, for instance, if we had if we made a bet and I won the bet and I took the money off the table, I didn't steal it from you. It was mine. I had a legal right to take it. There's infinite number of those cases, but the real question is who has a legal right to the money? And the fact is that if we just say taxation is theft, we ignore that question. We assume without argument that the government doesn't have a legal right to the money, or at least we don't address whether or not those laws are proper, whether they should have a legal right to the money. But to answer that question really requires us to ask a deeper question, which is, should the government have this legal right to engage in compulsory taxation? And that in turn requires an even deeper question, one that goes to what the proper purpose of government is. And that really, I think, is what these kinds of stock phrases, taxation and theft, is theft, really fails to answer. We basically take people who have a very different view of what the purpose of government is and say taxation is theft, and they have no clue even what we're talking about. And let's dig into that. Why is that? And we can put it this way. So if you view the purpose of government as protecting individual rights, if that's the only purpose of government, and you understand what individual rights are, then there is a sense in which you can say taxation is theft. Now, notice Ayn Rand, to my knowledge, certainly never in her major essays, never uses that phrase, which I think is revealing, because I still think you can call what the government does wrong or immoral, but it is legal. And I think theft, you really want to distinguish not simply that your property rights have been violated, but that they've been violated in a way not consonant with law. So taxation is certainly, from our perspective, a violation of property rights. but from our perspective. How many people really hold that perspective? Even people who pay lip service to that kind of view, who love the founding fathers and so on, even they, I think, really hold in many ways the opposite view. And this is that the government's role is any variant of the good of society, of serving the common good. I mean, this is what almost everybody else thinks. And from that perspective, then, it doesn't even make sense to say that taxation is theft. It's a necessary means of doing what's moral, of doing the right thing. You have to think about it from their terms, right? It's that, okay, we have the government, we need it to regulate, or the world is going to be a disaster. Greedy businessmen are going to destroy us. We need the government to redistribute wealth. We need the government to help out those in need. Otherwise, we'll live in a nightmarish world where people starve in the streets. We need government, yes, for functions that an individualist perspective would agree with, to have police or law courts and military, and clearly that has to be paid for. And so from this perspective, then, whenever people have this idea of, look, this is the moral purpose of government, there's no way that you can say the moral purpose of the government is to do all these things, and yet it's wrong for it to collect the money to do these things. Coercive taxation is wrong only from an individual's perspective, not from a collectivist perspective. And so if you actually want to be persuasive, if you actually want to convince people about how you think of taxes, you have to challenge that moral perspective. You have to challenge the moral perspective that leads them to support taxation. You can't win with a gotcha line. And this is kind of the widest and most important lesson. Like, we'll talk about taxes a little bit more. But anytime you take a complex issue and think you can win with a gotcha line, that is, you're really wasting your time. And indeed, I think in most cases, you're hurting yourself. You're making your job as a persuader harder. And I mean, think about when the other side does this to us. You're for capitalism. Who's going to pay for the roads? Who's going to build the roads? Has that ever convinced you? Now, it's not simply that you can say, well, I have an answer to that, but it's that no complex ideological issue is going to be solved with a meme. And so, okay, if our goal is really to have an inside joke that we can all laugh at, if it's to, you know, be funny and play to the tribe, as it were, great. Have your taxation or theft memes. If we're actually thinking of this as a campaign to be persuasive, I actually think it's counter effective. I think that it actually makes our job harder, because all people think is, these people are a joke. They're totally irrelevant. The government's doing all these things that are crucial for a moral and a proper society, they think. And so they want us to put an end to all that, to create some kind of disaster because they have a peculiar view that taxation is theft. Come on, these guys are silly and impractical. So my advice is, let's try to come up with a meme that really challenges the idea of the collective good of society as being the purpose of government. At least that will start the conversation in the right place. And then we can get to taxes last, because this is the thing about taxes. Taxes are not a primary issue. Your view of taxes is going to flow from your view of government, from your view of what government should do. And if you just try to lower tax rates, but you don't challenge what government should do, what are you going to get? Well, really what you're going to get is the last 30 years of government policy. That starting under Reagan, we've seen tax rates generally go down. We've succeeded in cutting taxes, you know, pretty significantly, at least in terms of marginal tax rates. And again, this is income taxes. Certainly many other taxes have gone up substantially. But the real problem is that the government kept spending more and more and more each year, because everybody agrees, yeah, the government needs to be engaged in a giant welfare state, a giant regulatory state. That's what you have to challenge. You have to challenge what the government is using the money for, with what government should be doing. After that, taxes are easy. I mean, look, if you get government, if you had the federal government back to 3% a year of GDP in terms of how much it cost, this is what it was roughly for all of American history, set aside Civil War up until World War I, 3% of GDP at the federal level. At that, there's not like an argument with somebody saying we need 70% tax rates. I mean, the government would need virtually nothing in order to fund its proper functions. So given an individual's view of government, then the question is, how should taxes be thought about? And there's certainly not an issue of fair share. And indeed, Ayn Rand's view is that compulsory taxation, force collecting the revenue that it needs to function, that's out. That taxation has to be voluntary. Now, again, I would recommend go back to her book, The Virtue of Selfishness, and read Government Financing in a Free Society. And it's very interesting how she approaches it. Again, she does not come out guns blazing with taxation as theft. She instead, she focuses on really what is the role of government. And then there's two things that you need to know. One is that the role of government is protector of rights. That throws out the idea that it can confiscate the money we've earned by right, that belongs to us about right, that precisely because it is a servant, it can't claim to be able to arbitrarily take as much money of it as it wants from people, that indeed it can't take any money from people. It has to gain their voluntary consent. And what she particularly stresses is that one of the key reasons why it's critical to keep even taxation for the necessary functions of government that we all need in order to live and be free voluntary is as a check on the growth of government, that one of the major, major destructive forces of making taxation compulsory is that it's there you lose the number one check on government, which is that it can fund all of these wealth redistribution schemes, all of these regulatory schemes, all of these government running this business and that business schemes, because it has this endless supply of money. She also stresses, though, and I think this is really interesting, that would be the last reform on the route to laissez-faire capitalism, not the first one, that you need to decontrol over time, and that the very kind of last step that you would be concerned with is being able to voluntarily fund the necessary purpose of government. Now, one issue in terms of persuasion, so I think she's totally right about that issue, but in terms of persuasion, I think there's one approach that I highly, highly encourage you to take when you're discussing these issues. So what will very often happen is you'll get into a debate. Say it's a debate about the welfare state. And you will stress, look, it is wrong to give money from that one person earned in order to give unearned handouts to other people. And then the next question will inevitably be some form of, so you're saying that taxation is wrong. Should there be any taxes? Clearly, we need some taxes. This is how I typically answer that. And I think that it's effective for a number of reasons that we can talk about. But basically, what I say is that, yeah, in the end, I'm against all taxation. But I know that that's a very radical proposition that very few people are going to agree with me on. But I think we can separate out two issues. So one issue is, do we need the compulsory taxation in order to fund the rights-protecting functions of government that we all require in order to live in a civilized society? That's one debate. We can have that debate. But it's a very, very different debate. It's a completely different question, which is, should the government be able to take some money that some people earned and give it to others who didn't earn it? In other words, wealth redistribution versus compulsory taxation to pay for the things that every individual needs in order to live, that is a very different moral issue. One of them, yeah, let's have that debate. And I think in the end, Ayn Rand is right and you need voluntary taxation, but that is a completely different debate than somebody whose basic view is some people should have to work without pay so that other people can get paid without working. Very, very different moral category. And I think that does a really good job of disarming this issue and allowing you to keep focused on this question. What is the moral purpose of government? Is it moral for government to be used as a tool to exploit some people for the sake of other people? Now, the last question on this tax thing that I want to come to is, what is the most outrageous tax? What's the most outrageous tax? And if you've been listening to me, I've already given you some clues as to what I think it is. I'd like to hear you tweet me yours. What do you think the most outrageous taxes are? Remember, at DWalkins3, the number 3. Is it the income tax? Above all, the progressive income tax? What about the death tax? Taxing people once they've died, reducing what they can give to their heirs. Piketty, our great foe of inequality, he wants to see inheritance taxes reach upwards of 80%. 80% of everything that you earn, want to pass on to your kids. Too bad, government's going to take that. Or what about the corporate income tax? I mean, this is an interesting one, in part because corporations don't pay taxes. That's with something like the corporate income tax, it's not clear who's paying it. Is it coming out of the pockets of shareholders? Is it coming out of the pockets of customers in the form of higher prices? Is it coming out of the pockets of employees? Is it affecting their wages? So some, taxes on corporations, it disguises where the burden falls. So is that the worst tax? What about tariffs? Tariffs, that basically a tax on wanting to buy or sell something to another country, to an individual in a different country. Or sales tax. There, you know, there's an argument of, hey, it's in a certain way voluntary, not really voluntary, but at least you can reduce your tax bill. You just buy less stuff. And hey, that will encourage investment. It will encourage capital accumulation. And hey, that's what drives, part of what drives economic progress. So, you know, that seems to be a good thing. But on the other hand, depending on how you structure it, a sales tax is a very regressive tax. It falls particularly hard on poor people. So what about that one? Or related to that, what about sin taxes? Taxes on cigarettes or alcohol, or nowadays in some places, soft drinks, sugary soft drinks. I think Chicago has a 9% sin tax on sugary sodas. I mean, here certainly is regressive. I mean, it's poorer people who tend to you know, smoke and drink and buy sugary sodas. Is that bad? And hey, that's the government trying to control our choices, trying to be paternalistic and tell us what it's going to put in our bodies. And I mean, the list goes on and on, right? We have property taxes that basically punish us for owning a home, particularly, I mean, in most places, a lot of your property taxes are going to the schools, which don't educate your kids. So my answer, though, I have a definite view on this. I think the worst tax is the payroll tax, Social Security, Medicare, 15.3% of what you earn, starting at first dollar. So it's not like the income tax where, hey, all right, we're not going to start, you know, really taxing you till you start making your way up the income ladder. From the first dollar you earn, 15.3%. That includes the part nominally paid by your employer, but really taken out of your paycheck in the form of lower wages. 15.3% for the payroll. Now, why do I say it's the worst? Well, in part, it's precisely the fact that it comes out of your first dollar, and it's huge, 15.3%. Now, it goes up only to a certain cap, but the cap is way more than most people make. I think it's something, I forget exactly what the number is, but it's somewhere plus or minus in the $200,000 range. But up to that, 15.3% of your income. Now, let's go back to the lessons that we took away from the discussion of taxation is theft. If all we have is taxation is theft, then no tax is really any better or any worse than any other. But if you keep in mind the purpose that a tax is meant to serve, that's what you have to really challenge. If people think that Social Security and Medicare, if they think that entitlements are good, if they're moral, if they're necessary, then they're going to support that. But here's what's really going on. 15.3% is just a number. But the reality is this. You're working for about a month and a half a year without pay just in order to give money to the elderly. That's what the payroll tax is. It's basically, we want to supply the elderly with these enormous handouts, and so we're going to make you work each year a month and a half without pay. That's the basic idea. Well, there goes a new car that you could have bought. I mean, in fact, that's what you're doing. You're buying more than a new car every year for the elderly. Now, I bought a used car, and not even the nicest one in the whole wide world, and it's taking a pretty good chunk out of my income, and it's taking 5 years to pay off. Like you guys, I'm paying, you know, for quite a nice car each year for the elderly. How is that fair? Now, of course, they'll say, hey, no, you're contributing towards a fund that you will get in old age. But of course, that's nonsense. All that's happening is basically today's retirees had a bunch of money stolen from them to give to their parents and grandparents. And now they're taking a bunch of money from me. And then the idea is someday I'll be able to sucker a whole bunch of people into paying for all my handouts. So the fact that basically you're going to get your handouts later, maybe if you live that long, if the government doesn't vote them away, that doesn't make it any better. But that's what is really going on with the payroll tax. And so that's why it gets my vote for the worst tax. It treats society as either burdens or resources. You're a burden when you're receiving your share of the 15.3% tax, and you're a resource when you're being exploited to pay for other people's old age needs. So let's wrap up then tax day. The main lesson I think to reiterate is this idea of that we shouldn't start from the premise that fairness consists of raising as much money as possible by taking as much money from people who can, quote, afford it. It should be the unfairness, and then it's unfair for them to try to shield that money from the government. It's that unfairness is really when the government takes the money, when the government is redistributing what you earn. But that to actually persuade people on this issue, you can't focus primarily on taxes. Taxes come later in the discussion. What you really need to get at is the purpose of a given program, or more broadly, the purpose of government. That if you think the purpose of government is serving the collective well-being of society and that trumps the rights of the individual, well, then you're not going to convince them on taxes. But you're certainly not going to convince them that taxation is theft. But if you're able to convince them of an individualist approach, that each individual has a right to exist for his own sake, to keep what he earns, then convincing people on taxes is pretty easy. It's, hey, did you earn it? Well, if so, then the government's job is to protect it, to take it. So coming up after the break, we are going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to be talking about some upcoming events. And we're going to be talking, as I said, at the top of the program, we're going to be talking with Josh Windham from the group Strive about a really interesting push that they have going on. So stay tuned, and we'll be back in a little bit.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, who cares? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn, and the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, this is Don Watkins, and we're back on the Yaron Brook Show. So we have had quite a few events in the past few weeks now, really mostly promoting Equal is Unfair. As I mentioned, Yaron is in Brazil right now. And I just got back from a trip. I went, it was New York, did a bunch of things there, including a launch event with Yaron that was a ton of fun. We went to, I went to DC after that for another week, and that was fun. I mean, we went up and spoke to congressional staffers. I got a chance to speak to this really amazing organization called the Benjamin Rush Institute, which is a free market think tank that focuses on healthcare issues. And they were having a conference up there, and the students were just really smart, a lot of the medical students, and really interested in this idea of economic inequality, which they, part of how the whole healthcare debate is framed is in terms of economic inequality. And so they found that really valuable, and I had a lot of fun there. One of the interesting highlights was I got to do a panel sponsored by Economics 21, which is a part of the Manhattan Institute down in DC. And there I got to be in a panel discussing inequality with Scott Winship from Manhattan Institute, who, if you've read our book, Equals Unfair, I think is one of the best people at explaining and really digging into the statistics that are thrown around the inequality debate. Now, for Scott's sake, I will reiterate that, you know, he definitely does not support all our views, but we've been very friendly. He's been on my podcast several times, the Debt Dialogues. And so it was great to be on a panel with him and finally meet in person. We also on the panel was from a senior fellow at Brookings, Richard Reeves. And Reeves is, I mean, he's basically my favorite liberal. I find him delightful and insightful and honest. And actually, there are areas that we have more or less agreement on. So he basically believes that the gap is overhyped, that people are too worried about gaps. And I can certainly agree with him there emphatically. And he's focused more on the issue of mobility. And I think I don't agree with everything that in terms of how he thinks about mobility, but he and Brookings more broadly have put out some good things that kind of mirrors many of the points that Yaron and I make in Equals Unfair about the way that the government interventionist policies really have put roadblocks in the path towards mobility from those starting at the bottom. So that was just a fun panel. We have some events coming up and I'm going to have a guest on to talk about one of them, but the best thing you can do is go to ariayrand.org/events. You'll find everything listed with the most up-to-date information. For those in Southern California, though, next Tuesday, April 19th, I'm going to be speaking at ARI headquarters here in Irvine. I'm going to be speaking on inequality, going to be signing books. And so, again, you can find more information at our website, just ariayrand.org/events. The next day, I'm going to be flying down to Tucson, Arizona, at the University of Arizona. I'm going to be giving a talk for Strive Clubs. And so we'll be hearing more about Strive later in the show. Then I fly back to LA, where I will be giving a talk that we're now going to, you're going to hear a little bit more about that in one second as we bring in our guest. So let's see if I can, there we go. All right, Darius, you there?
Yes, hi, John.
All right, introduce yourself to everyone.
Yeah, hi, everyone. I'm Darius Gagne. I run the Los Angeles Objectivist Club, and we're hosting Don Plotkin next Thursday, April 21st, in Santa Monica.
So, what am I going to be speaking on?
You will be speaking about your new book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality.
All right. Well, I knew that. I just thought I'd throw an easy one at you. So tell everybody a little bit about the club and then how they can find out more information.
We're a group of objectivists or people interested in objectivism. And we get together from time to time and apply objectivism to real-world events in life. And we try to have events, and having you speak is about as good as we can hope. We're really excited about it. We have a little website.
Yeah, go ahead and throw out the URL.
Yeah, it's losangelesobjectivist.com.
Oh, well, that's easy enough to remember.
So if you go to the events tab, you'll find the event for next week.
Yeah, I'm excited to do this one. We have a lot of supporters in the LA area, and I haven't actually gotten to speak that much, certainly not in recent years up there. And it's convenient because I'll be flying back in from wherever I am in Arizona into LAX, and I'll actually be able to do something fun rather than jump in a car and drive, you know, the 12 hours that it takes in rush hour traffic to do it. What are some of the other things you do besides events with the club, and what maybe some kind of past things, just to give people a flavor? Because I'm just eager for everybody who's in the Southern California area. There's so many opportunities to get more engaged with the philosophy, with what's going on, and so kind of lay out for them the bigger picture.
Sure. So we meet probably every few months, and we're not a big group. The events are not complicated. They're not elaborate. A lot of them have been at my home, and it's very casual. But we just really enjoy getting into discussion, and there's no commitment, and we were looking for new members. So feel free to reach out to me. My email address is on our website.
So just before we wrap up, I think we've met now twice. The first time was at our New York event.
It was at Strive.
Oh, that's right. It was at Strive. And I think one thing that's helpful to know, for people who haven't been to any sort of get together among objectivists, you can sometimes, I think some people have they don't know what to expect. So I wonder if you could just say a little bit about kind of who you are. And I think you have a really interesting story and give people a flavor of, this is not going to be your kind of, I've been to, certain Tea Party groups or even libertarian clubs have had me in sometimes, and you kind of get the people who live out in the cabin and collect gold and guns. But I think with objectivists, you tend to get much more, people who are just really passionate, successful. And so maybe fill them in a little bit about who you are, just so they have a better sense of what they could be getting themselves into.
Yeah, thanks. I'm originally a physicist. I did my PhD at UCLA, and I went on to work in Wall Street. And I was a quantitative analyst, and I went on to create my own wealth management firm, which eventually I merged with my current firm, Abacus Wealth Partners. And the event next week is, in fact, located at our headquarters, Abacus's headquarters in Santa Monica. A lot of our members of the LA Objectivist Club tend to be professionals. We would love to attract and find more younger students. That would be great. But as of now, it tends to be mostly professionals. And the thing about the west side of Los Angeles, Don, as Bonnie knows, capitalism is alive and well here. Commerce, wealth creation, they're alive and well here. But altruism, collectivism, the concept of the greater good, what's best for society, that other world is alive and well here as well. So we live deep in a mixed economy, mixed ethics, mixed society here.
Yeah, so great. I hope everybody can make it out. Again, that's going to be this coming Wednesday, by the time you hear this record, Thursday, excuse me. April 21st. And what's the URL again?
LosAngelesObjectivist.com.
Awesome. And just for the record, so, my son's middle name is Atticus, and we took that from To Kill a Mockingbird, but I almost wish now we had taken it from a financial firm, just because that that is something that deserves. Not enough people name their kids after financiers and financial firms. That's I think, the lesson for today. Well, great.
Well, just
I'm really
to clarify,
yeah.
Don, the firm is called Abacus, like a calculator from ancient Chinese culture.
Oh, well, then I take back everything I said. It's all about To Kill a Mockingbird, and you've betrayed me enormously. No, I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks, and I hope everyone can make it out next week.
Great. Thanks, Don. Looking forward to seeing you next week.
All right. So we are going to figure out how to close off the call. All right. Success. So we're going to take a real quick break. And when we come back, we will be talking with Josh Windham from Strive. So stay tuned.
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your...
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, who cares? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn. And the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
This is Don Watkins back. We're sitting in the Yaron Brook Show. So our next guest has not arrived. So I'm actually going to jump right into something that I was saving for the end. In the end, we try to give something that's positive, something that we can get excited about on the show. And this is... not usually the typical thing, you know, we like to do maybe with entertainment or whatever, although this was definitely entertaining. So my friend and former ARI colleague, Alex Epstein, the founder of the Center for Industrial Progress, actually went before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee today and made the moral case for fossil fuels. Now, you have to understand the setting here. The setting is some of the actual politicians in the Senate, Barbara Boxer, Sheldon Whitehouse, the people actually trying to impose the policies that will destroy the fossil fuel industry and all American industry, they were sitting right there in front of them. And you can go online and find it. If you go to my Twitter feed, at DWatkins3, you can find me tweeting out the video of this. Alex, to their face, you know, took them on, challenged them, made a persuasive case for energy liberation. And actually, and this is the coolest thing I have ever seen, Senator Whitehouse, if you don't know, recently penned a Washington Post piece basically calling on the government to punish those who have spoken out against, you know, the climate catastrophe crusade. And Alex said that, you know, anybody specifically naming White House who is a member of the government and is trying to shut down the free speech of Americans should resign, should apologize and resign. Really amazing moment. So much credit to Alex. Check out my Twitter feed at DWatkins3. You can find the video. So now I want to turn to a really new cool thing that's being undertaken by the editor-in-chief of The Undercurrent and member of Strive, Josh Windham. Let's see if we can get him on the line. Josh, are you there?
Hey, Doc.
Yeah, I can hear you. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. So let's before we get started with the specific program that you guys are in the middle of right now, tell everybody a little bit who don't know about Strive and The Undercurrent and what you guys do.
Okay, so basically The Undercurrent is Strive's national campus publication. And The Undercurrent has written commentary for a long time for a college audience from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy. And Strive is our national network of student clubs, and we do leadership development from the perspective of Rand's philosophy as well.
All right. So what are you guys up to right now?
So we noticed that there was this feel the burn hashtag going around. And you might have seen this hashtag resist capitalism as well. So our thought is, you know, we want to go viral too. And we want to start a movement where students write in expressing that they're proud to be capitalist, or at least in favor of capitalism. And so our initiative is hashtag capitalism proud.
So say a little bit more then about what exactly are you guys doing? What should other people do to participate? What kind of impact do you hope to have?
Well, two things. The first is that the Ayn Rand Institute is holding a campus writing contest. So if you write in to your campus paper and you explain the morality of capitalism and you defend capitalism and your piece gets published, you're eligible for a $1,000 prize if you win. The trouble is that a lot of campus papers are pretty socialist. So The Undercurrent has committed to posting any submissions to our blog, and because we're a campus publication, that'll automatically qualify students for ARI's contest. And the other thing I mentioned, too, is that we're trying to get people to be more active on social media to promote the idea that it's good to be capitalist and that we can be proud to be capitalist. So we want people to tweet at us at The Undercurrent, or comment on our page, our Strive page, or our Facebook page for TU, and just let us know why you're proud to be capitalist.
So to back up for a second, so those who don't know, the Feel the Burn, this is the, you know, B-E-R-N for Bernie. And I mean, it definitely blew up. I think it actually, though, is easier to make fun of, you know, than anything. You know, are you feeling the burn now is a great comeback to any outrageous thing that the government does? But no, so I'm glad to see trying to get people more engaged in this. What's been the response so far?
We've had a good number of students send their submissions in to us, indicating that they're maybe either sent their pieces to their papers and they're waiting to hear back, or they're planning to do that. And we're in the process of getting those pushed on our blog, and you'll see some trickling out within the next couple of weeks. We've already posted one. Actually, we had a high school student, Robert Mack, write one, which is pretty cool. We're glad to see a high school student engage with this. We've also, and I'll be frank, we've also received some outspoken socialists kind of pushing back pretty hard against us. So this is just more evidence that this is really necessary, really a thing that we ought to be doing, and that we need to speak out, or else, you know, we're just going to be swallowed on campuses in this sort of socialist wave.
Yeah, I mean, if nobody's attacking you for advocating controversial ideas, it's because you're not doing a good job. It's because you're not breaking through the noise. So I think it's, you know, you should be capitalist and proud and hated for being a capitalist and proud.
And I'm sure you've gotten your fair share of that.
Yeah, although I'd like to have more hatred. One of the things that happened very shortly after it came out, all the people who were actually going to read the book and give honest reviews, that they needed some time to read the book. But people who read the title or who read the description and automatically hated it, they wasted no time in writing reviews of a book that they hadn't read. So luckily our readers have swamped them out the actual readers have swamped them out now with the positive reviews. But no doubt, like it's if you're actually going to get in the fight, it's a dirty fight and you need to be prepared for that. But no, it's great to see that there is a response. A lot of our listeners aren't college students. What can they do either for this particular initiative or more broadly if they're interested to learn more about Strive's mission and ways that they can help Strive and then the things, because often Strive works very closely with ARI. What are some things that they can do?
So, a couple things. First of all, hopefully, you're looking. I think they do. They know young people. So, you know, share the initiative on social media. Go to our Facebook page, and you'll see the pinned post there, or our Twitter page @GenderCurrent, and you'll see the pinned post there. And just share that around, and hopefully, we can get some young people aware of this if they're not already aware of it. You know, the second thing is speak up. You know, we like to hear from you guys, even if it's not a tweet, even if it's not a Facebook post or a message. You know, send us an email, and we have email information on our pinned post as well. Just let us know why you're proud to be capitalist, and you know, we really want to get this conversation started with all of you guys.
So, before we go, what is your impression? All we hear from the media is basically that like colleges are pure kind of like Bernie insulator zones, or I don't even know what the terminology would be, but basically like you're producing Bernie fanatics like cockroaches. What's your experience? Is that true? Are these loud, outspoken people calling for socialism on campuses? Are they really representing most of the students? What's your take on what's really going on campuses right now?
There is data that says that, you know, an increasing number of students are in favor of socialism, but you know, there are a couple problems with that. First of all, it's not clear that they all actually know what socialism is when they're talking about it. Second thing is that, you know, it's not the majority of students. And if you talk to kind of the average college student, I think there's a defense that they recoil against Bernie and that they recoil against someone like Trump as well. So there's this, in my opinion, sort of ethos of recoiling against authoritarianism. I think there's something that is positive there that we can build off of and sort of work to cultivate. And I'm hoping that that's what Strive can do on campuses. So I forgot to mention, if you're interested in learning more about Strive and you're part of the regular audience here, just check out striveclubs.org. There's information on how you guys can get involved and how you can support us on campus and hopefully help Strive to grow so that we can start to cultivate these students who are anti-authoritarian and want to be leaders and entrepreneurial in their own lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think we really need, I mean, if there's going to be a successful shift towards capitalism, towards free markets, there has to be a shift among college students. And if you think about what somebody like Sanders has going for him, I mean, I think there's two major factors contributing to it. So take something like free college, right? On the one hand, that you get to inspire, he's inspiring people to feel good about themselves by saying, look, you can help me in the fight to provide education for everyone, free education for everyone. So they basically get to, you know, build their self-esteem by being on the side of morality. And then the second part, and this breaks through sometimes in their comments, but they usually don't lead with it, is it also appeals to greed for the unearned. So it's, hey, maybe I won't have to pay for my college, or I won't have to pay my college loans. And I think that, you know, one of the things I've seen just on this particular argument that the free market side typically does wrong is that their next response when they hear that is, well, look how expensive it will be. And then they start trotting out numbers and it'll be, you know, $1 trillion or something like that. The point I always stress is, no, you have to think about this in moral terms, which is, wait, so basically I have to work really hard in order to pay for the education of somebody who's going to go to school, study a topic I don't like, and then go around railing about how we have to destroy capitalism. So, you know, or a businessman has to be basically working to send kids to school to learn about how business is evil. Like this idea that people are entitled to an education and that everybody's going to have to pay for that. But the bigger issue here then is that what you have to do is expose, if you actually want to reach college students, Sanders is not just like a fount of charisma and sex appeal. He has these kind of powerful ideas. And so we need to have a moral alternative. And I think that's certainly, like, Ayn Rand is really central to having a moral alternative. And then when you have something like capitalist and proud, like, proud is an important word there, right? It's not just, hey, I like capitalism, or feel the gap, or something like that. It's capitalist and proud. It's digging into that moral view. And so I think that's very powerful.
Yeah, and I want to say one more thing on that. I mean, we chose that word very intentionally. So, you know, being prideful isn't just like a label you slap onto yourself, right? Like any virtue, you know, being proud is an activity. It's something that you maintain over time. And so if you're capitalist and proud, that doesn't mean that you just send a tweet in, right? That means that that's part of who you are, and that you're living that pride every day, and you're taking actions to sort of vindicate it and to prove that you actually are proud to be capitalist. It's more than just a label. It's going out there and being an example for others and engaging in discussions like these and getting the word out there.
Awesome. So one more time, can you give those URLs to people who want to find out more about this?
Sure, yeah. Thriveclub.org is our broader organization, and TheUndercurrent.org is our blog, obviously. At TheUndercurrent is our Twitter, and if you want to find out more about the initiative, just look at our pinned tweet there or a pinned post on Facebook.com/TheUndercurrent, and you can share that around and get the word out about hashtag capitalist and proud.
All right. That is Josh Windham, and thanks. Good luck in your campaign, and everybody give it your support. They're doing important work, and especially when I want to see more students entering the essay contest and really, instead of feeling the burn, being capitalist and proud.
Thanks so much.
Yep. That has been our show. So, you know, pay your taxes so you don't get thrown in jail, and reduce your tax bill by donating tons of money to the Ayn Rand Institute. But in the meanwhile, keep fighting for capitalism. That's it for today in the Yaron Brooks Show. Talk to you next time.